Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
D.S. Kane is not his real name. He was involved in covert espionage operations for U.S. intelligence service. Since retiring, he's written a series of spy novels, changing just enough of the facts to keep him out of trouble. I've read the first in the series, Blood Ridge, quite an eye-opener, especially Chapter 10. Make sure you read that if you get that. It really says a whole lot. In this morning's installment of this show's feature, What Is It Really Like to Be a Whatever?, D.S. Kane is here in the studio to tell us about what it's really like to be a spy. D.S., welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I want to thank you again for the invitation.
It's my pleasure. Well, I've been looking forward to this as well. In the 26 years in the show, I've never talked to a spy. So just don't pull out some James Bond weapon and destroy me if you don't like my first question or whatever. Let's get, you know, most people these days, when we're, you know, and certainly consumers of the media, we hear about torture, that there's all this torture going on. Have you ever been involved in or observed torture?
No, I haven't. And the only way I think it might ever work is if the target has a family. And if you can manage to get them as hostages, put the target, bind them, put them in a chair and put a TV in front of them and let them watch their children being tortured, that would make them talk.
And is that theory, or is that the spy novelist in you, or have you heard, you know, in the world in which you worked for how many years were you a spy, covert operative, whatever?
I spent a decade in covert.
Have you heard
ops.
Of any, when you were in there, have you heard of stuff like that?
No.
Okay. Another topic. CIA has been accused of money laundering. Are you aware of any instance of U.S. intelligence entity doing money laundering that you can talk about?
I'm aware of it, and no, I can't really talk about it directly, but I can tell you this. Every spy service is like an iceberg. What the public sees is just the tip of the iceberg, but what is underneath the iceberg, not even Congress knows about.
What can you tell us that's under the iceberg?
Well, we put covert agents, not black ops people, but covert agents.
Black ops are those that are involved with death, killing somebody.
That's correct. Covert agents are those involved in infiltration, becoming a friend of the targets, gaining their trust, serving them, and while doing that, stealing their secrets, both electronic and personal.
You're saying that that's a good definition of it. Now tell me, though, you say that we only see the tip of the iceberg. Tell us more about what's below the iceberg. What might surprise my listeners as to what actually is going on?
Well, we spy on our allies. It's recently come to light that the NSA took Angela Merkel's telephone conversations.
Sure.
That was done electronically. But we also have people in country doing the same exact thing, but not electronically.
Okay. How about in this country? Are you aware of how much espionage goes on in this country?
We spy on our own citizens, the Russians, the Chinese, the Koreans, and everybody else spies on us. It's I can't find a kind word for this, and the only thing I can think of is really nasty. So I'm just going to say that it's like a revolving shooting range where everybody wants what everybody else has. Now, what you need to understand here, though, is that the key to espionage is deception. The Mossad's motto, for example, is...
The Mossad, that's the Israeli intelligence
agency.
That's
correct, yeah. The Mossad's motto is, through deception we wage war. This is how most espionage is done. My life as a spy was... truths I withheld and lies I told.
Now, I would imagine that you have to be trained to be a great liar. Is that correct? As an espionage person?
Yes.
Tell me what you learned about how to lie without being detected.
Well, if you're just talking to somebody, focus on the bridge of the person's nose. Don't look left, don't look right, and certainly don't look down. So as long as there's direct contact, and your voice doesn't indicate that you're trying to deflect, you will be perceived as truthful.
What about the fact that, I imagine at some point you're either asked to take a lie detector test or whatever. How do you, there is tell, not there are no guaranteed tells, but there are ways to, when there is a change from baseline, for example, they're asking you nice innocuous questions and you're one way, and then suddenly, they're asking you a difficult question, your voice gets higher or lower, you take a deep breath or whatever. How do you avoid those biological tells, which are especially apparent if you're taking a lie detector test?
They're very difficult to get around. And in order to do it, you need to inflict a little bit of pain on yourself.
Like pinching yourself sub rosa?
Like that, yes. Here I have Here I have my thumbnail biting into my index finger. As long as I can do that under the table so it's not noticed by the person administering the test, I'm fine.
You also, in preparation for the show in our pre-interview, you talked about the fact that kind of keeping in your mind a very pleasant memory as you're talking to keep that heart rate and blood pressure and therefore the concomitant variables under control. So thinking about making love to your wife or whatever, like that?
Yes, it works. And the exact reverse is true. When they ask you a question that uses the baseline, inflict a little bit of pain on yourself. So it balances out.
Interesting. You would you mentioned the NSA. Having worked undercover for an intelligence agency, including the NSA, but there's, you said there were like 1,200 different intelligence services at the United States. We are the land of bureaucracy. Are you more or less respecting of U.S. intelligence agencies, from the CIA to the NSA to Black Hawk or whatever it's called,
Blackwater.
Are you more or less respecting of those entities from having been in that for a decade?
I'm on both sides of this coin, and I'll give you both sides of it. First of all, I am in awe of the work they do under the amount of danger that they're subjected. These people put their lives out on the line to do what is best for America, what they think is best for America. Now, the other side of this is that they tend often to go too far. The NSA is the major culprit in this. Their original charter, as I understand it, is to protect America's information on computers, both our corporate and our personal, and our banking information. And at this, they've been a total failure. What they've been a grand success at is invading American privacy. The NSA, as I look at it, is a monster.
And in some sense, that's sort of Congress's role. If you look as an outsider now, having been out of the intelligence service for a while, there is, you're always hearing about, hearings about waterboarding, hearing about the NSA, hearing about, especially overreach. Do you, as much as you can be a statesman at this point, do you think that Congress's oversight is overmanaging, undermanaging, or about right?
Okay, on this one, again, I'm on both sides. First, Congress leaks like a sieve. So anything you tell Congress is going to eventually reach a whole bunch of unintended recipients.
Like the New York Times.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's called leaks. And that happens all the time. On the other hand, if you take a look at what happened between the Senate and the CIA over the torture issue, it's recently come to light that the CIA spied on the Senate's computers. They hacked the Senate's computers. And the Senate hacked the CIA's computers. Now, it just so happens that there's a law that was signed by President Obama about a couple of years ago that says it's a felony to hack a federal computer, which means that both the CIA and the Senate are guilty of felonies.
Let's turn to the more personal side. First of all, let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am talking with a guy whose pseudonym is D.S. Kane. He was, for a decade, an undercover, covert espionage operative for a U.S. intelligence service. And since he's retired, he's written a series of spy novels, five completed now. Is that right?
That's correct.
Including the most—I read the first. It's called Blood Ridge. He's with us talking about what it's really like to be a spy. So let's talk a little more personally. I want to, you know, forgive me, I'm still being like a kid who's still reading, you know, DC Comics, you know, adventure things. But tell me more about the kinds of deception you actually did when you were a spy.
Okay. I was asked to investigate a bank. It just so happens that they had started out being a client. So I traveled to their...
You were like a double agent, in a sense.
Yes. At the time, I was a management consultant. I was faculty at the Stern Graduate School of Business at NYU. I had credentials...
That was your cover.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I visited them. They welcomed me in. We spent some time... I talked with the president of the bank and a whole bunch of other people and gained their trust. While I was there... I had access to all their computer records, as well as them personally.
All the one guy who's brought from the outside had access to all their computer records? How the hell did you get that?
I was asked to audit the bank by another bank that wanted to know if they should sponsor this bank for entry into one of the financial systems.
Wow. Okay. Tell me one more story. What's one? That's a big one. That's huge. Okay, tell me one more story of an espionage thing that you did while working for a U.S. intelligence service.
This one, I'm going to have to disguise it a little bit. If I don't, this one could come right back on me.
That's fine.
One of the departments of the United States government, we investigated them. We basically went through every one of their computer systems and looked for traces that would indicate something was going wrong. Okay, and on that one, we spent about 3 months.
You know, when you talk about deception being so key to the whole thing, does that affect your life in terms of how much you trust others? Because as you're trying to deceive people when you were a spy, and who knows, and I'm sure it's very tempting to use the skills you acquired, you know, as a spy in your real life, have you become a more trusting person, a less trusting person in your real life?
Much less trusting. The first of the Moscow rules, which they train spies, is trust no one. Don't trust the people you work for. Don't trust the people you work with. Don't trust the people you're targeting. Don't trust your friends. Don't trust your spouse.
Does that make your life difficult?
I sure did.
Tell me more.
Well, Andrea, my wife... Mm-hmm.
Andrea Baum, by the way, who was a guest on the show, is a preeminent children's book agent, and so that's who we're talking about here. Go ahead.
Andrea never knew what I was doing as a covert espionage agent for the first 20 years of our marriage.
Wow.
And when I finally told her, she didn't believe me.
Huh. Right. I can imagine. So... you can't have utter distrust. I mean, you give your credit card information to a stranger when you walk into a restaurant and they could take it and they could go and take Tahiti on your credit card. There is somebody who says, I'm going to meet you at 12 o'clock and you trust that they're going to be there and you show up. What have you developed a refined sense of how to assess how much you can trust in a given person?
Well, their old habits die very, very slowly, if at all. When I get to a restaurant, I tend to sit with my back against the wall, close to a door.
Wow.
I go to meet somebody, I tend to show up about 15 minutes early, and I do what's referred to as a surveillance detection route.
So tell me a little bit about right now. I mean, you're interacting with me. You've interacted with me before when Andrea came in, simply as the spouse who came into the studio, and then we've had some interactions afterwards. To what extent, how do you assess the extent to which you can trust me not to hurt you?
Our relationship isn't based on trust. It's based on an exchange.
Okay, so it's an irrelevant question. I'm trying to create some immediacy about this trust assessment issue.
Yeah, so trust is not an issue. But that doesn't necessarily mean I do or I don't trust you.
But you have a tremendous power to screw you right here. That could be very tough.
Yes.
And I could say what a crappy novels you wrote, or that you're really not coming. I mean, I do have a fair amount of power here, right?
You have a lot of power here.
And yet you've trusted that I wasn't going to screw you.
Yes.
Why?
Because it's not in your best interests or my best interests to do either screw me or to promote me.
It's wrong. And, you know, so many shows have stayed alive because they were ridiculing the guest, and audiences love to see the skewering of the guest.
True. Yeah. And I am not defenseless.
Okay. Well, I would, anyway, what would you, this is just for play. If you're not defenseless, let's say I was skewering your book and I ridiculed aspects of its character or its plot development or whatever, or that it, or anything, what kind of defenses?
Well, you know, if you read the reviews of my books on Amazon, you'll find a different story. I come out with very high reviews. Somebody said that one of my female protagonists was, quote, like Lisbeth Salander of the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and that one of my male protagonists was a Jason Bourne lookalike.
Let's go another direction.
Yeah.
Again, dear listeners, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. This is in today's installment of my semi-regular series, What's It Really Like to Be A? We're doing What's It Really Like to Be a Spy? I'm talking with a guy whose pseudonym is D.S. Kane. He was an intelligence operative for U.S. Intelligence Service for over a decade. He's now written 5 spy novels, the first of which is Blood Ridge. And recommending that if you do start that series, which I do commend to you, that you at least start with that book, and maybe even if you, you know, as a starting place, start with chapter 10 and then see where you want to go from there. Okay, let's turn to what I find fun, and maybe our listeners would find fun as well. The actual real-world threats. You've been on the inside, so you see threats. Is there a, you know, one of your specializations was cyber threats. Is there a cyber threat that particularly worries you?
There's more than one, but yes. First of all, America, as a cyber war agent, is not within the top 5 on the planet. The Russians,
in terms of capabilities.
In terms of capabilities, either offensive or defensive. Mm. Nobody has good defensive capabilities. That's true. Mm. But we have terrible offensive capabilities.
Who are the top 5?
The top 5 are first Russia, second China, third North Korea, fourth the Mossad, and fifth Saudi Arabia. Then after that, you come to the United States.
So what's the particular cyber attack that keeps you awake at night, if any?
Well, first let me say why that is the case.
Okay.
Because we prosecute hackers. Mm. Because of that, we can't find the best hackers to work for us.
Mm.
You know, if you take somebody's brother and then you go and you offer employment to them, they're going to say, what am I getting myself into?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. The top threats are the threats that the NSA is not looking at. The first top threat is protecting America's electric grid.
Hmm.
Because if the electric grid comes down, we will have massive numbers of deaths within about 3 weeks.
So how could, I mean, that makes perfect sense. You drop the electric, I mean, I remember just this weekend, there was a little computer glitch in the airline system and it paralyzed half the Eastern Seaboard's airplane. How could the NSA not be focusing on the electricity grid?
Well, we're focused more on the potential for terrorism from American citizens. That's what the NSA is doing. They're basically spending all of their time and money building vaults to store America's phone records.
Yeah. So that's a real, there's no question that's a real, I don't want to keep banging on the NSA. We got that one. So
okay.
Let me, that one is certainly, I can't top that in terms of, at least I can, in terms of scary scenarios. But first, I'd like to actually give out the phone number. I want to share my scary scenario in a moment for what I would hope that one of our 1,200 intelligence services is somehow addressing. But first, I would like to give you a shot at, pardon the pun, my guest D.S. Kane, who's here to talk about what it's been like to be a spy. If you have a question for him, I will invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let me tell you the cyber threat that, I sleep like a baby, but if I didn't, it would be the one that would keep me up at night. And that is this. If I am a disgruntled scientist, a nuclear engineer, I have access to all kinds of irradiating equipment, and dimes are the most portable, it's the lightest weight and most portable vehicle for transmitting this. I would go and I would irradiate, 10,000 dimes, And then I would go, and I would go to an international casino that, like in Las Vegas, for example, at the Bellagio, and I would go in the middle of the night to the 13th floor or some, you know, high floor where there's just a patron room, and I would copy their stationery and say, you know, have the Bellagio stationery and say, good luck in, you know, welcome to the Bellagio, good luck. And I would give them 10 or 20 dimes, and I'd put an envelope with that under every door so that there'd be like 50 different rooms, and these are people from all over the world, and they're going to go and they're going to now have these dimes they're going to now put in circulation. Some of which are going to, and they'll be unstoppable. And the half-life of uranium is 4 billion years, so that would eventually spread and cause near Armageddon. That's a scenario that scares me. Your reaction?
Well, that's a nightmare scenario that I'm sure most of the people in intelligence services haven't yet thought of, but they will now.
Good. Believe me. But I also think that it's not as easy to pull off as any of these are the things that make it in the spy novels all the time, right?
And so, absolutely.
You know, so it's not that these are any of these are secrets. I can come up with many more.
Sure.
Let me come up with one more, and then we'll go to something else. Okay. So now, instead of a nuclear engineer, I'm a biologist, and I'm disgruntled. I didn't get tenure, and I'm really angry, and I was also pretty crazy to begin with, as I know a few professors who are. And so what I do is I take the smallpox, which is available to professors and can be, you know, mutated in an X-ray machine to be not even any kind of stockpile of it. I then create enough of the smallpox virus. I then go to an international airport like SFO, San Francisco Airport or JFK, and I'm going to go to the area that is not patrol, which is I'm going to go to one of these remote airport parking lots, and I'm going to have a briefcase like everybody else, and I've got a vial in the briefcase. I'm going to open the briefcase, and I'm simply going to let the bacillus or virus, whatever the hell smallpox is, into the atmosphere, and everybody on this packed long-term parking bus is going to breathe this crap, and it's highly communicable, and now it's spread all over the world. Again, near Armageddon scenario. Is this delusional spy writing, or is this a realistic threat?
This has actually been done by television programs, yes. And it is not an unrealistic threat. It's something that I think bothers some of the intelligence people all the time.
Why the hell hasn't it happened yet? I mean, if I can think of this crap, you know, myself, I'm a mild-mannered career counselor, you know, Clark Kent. Why is, with 7.7 billion people on the planet, 7.3 billion, why has this, something like this, not happened? Why are they still, we're still raising our hands about chemical warfare that ISIS may be using, that's small potatoes, mustard gas versus what I'm talking about here? Why hasn't a big thing like this been attempted?
We don't know if it hasn't. In fact, the way I look at it is that one of the reasons I hold our intelligence services and agencies in awe is that this is their job. These are the things that they do think about. You know, I mean, what happens during lunch at an intelligence service is the way I see it is that they sit around the lunch table talking about these kinds of things. And eventually plans for these things do get drawn up.
I just can't imagine. 7.3 billion people. Any lone wolf can do this crap. It's not like you're under surveillance. You're not a group. You know, some disgruntled anybody can do some, inject an orange in the supermarket with some communicable virus, you know. It makes me crazy. Anyway, let me give out the phone number one more time, and then we'll go to the phones. If you or if you've got a question for my guest, D.S. Kane, the former spy who is now the author of a series of spy novels led by Bloodridge, I invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, for your question for him is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's your question for D.S. Kane?
I have two quick questions.
Yeah.
Question one is, you mentioned lying at the top of the show,
right.
And how do you detect the difference between someone who's nervous and someone who's lying? Don't they look a lot the same?
Okay.
And then the second question,
let's take one at a time. So the first question is, how do you tell the difference between somebody who's nervous versus somebody who's lying?
Difficult. Very difficult. The reason why they ask baseline questions is to try and establish what that difference is. And if what you want to do is conceal a lie, you want to make it as difficult as possible for them to see that in the baseline.
So the baseline means, so they're asking you first about what you ate for breakfast, and what did you, you know, what, tell me about your best friend and your dog and whatever. And then they say, oh, what did you do on Thursday night at 5 o'clock? You know? And so hopefully there's a change in the baseline, and that can assess whether you're lying or not. What's your second question?
Interesting. So I'm sorry. You're saying that you make the truth like the lie, so that when the lie comes up, it's the same.
Exactly.
But I'm wondering, from a job interview job interview situation, how one can calm themselves so that they appear truthful in an interview situation, but in a non-lying manner. My actual second question is that, your scenarios you were throwing out there for terrorists, aren't we at this time, we've seen in the last couple of years, everyone wants to go to the cloud, and among that is our energy or utilities, gas and electric. If you were a foreign country or Eastern Europe there, and you wanted to extort money or cause damage, isn't this the greatest gift you could have, is to have all this on the cloud? So aren't we moving things to the cloud at the exact worst time when they can be manipulated?
Yes. Let me top off the first question before we go to the second one. I'm not a career counselor, but in order to appear to be truthful when you're not in an interview situation, I would advise you to start your answer with a deep breath.
And I'm going to say that's fine. I'm sure that will help. That lowers your blood pressure and heart rate. I understand that. But I'm going to ask you the following, and forgive me, I could never have given this answer, dear caller, 10 years ago. But the older I get and the more I've been a career counselor, the more I believe that's the wrong question. If, in fact, you've got to do lying to get the job, it's probably the wrong job. What you really want to do is you want to speak your truth. Here are my strengths. Here are my weaknesses. Like on a first date. If I were single, I would tell on a first date my date that I work 70 hours a week. And if you're looking for somebody to take early retirement and play with you, you got the wrong guy. Now, I could lie and talk about what a funster I am and whatever, but ultimately it's going to bite me. I really profoundly believe that the best job seeker is someone who is really quite candid, both for two reasons. One is pragmatic. They'll trust you more because they always think the job seekers are full of it. And if you admit to a weakness or whatever, they're going to trust much more of what you say. But the second issue is you're more likely to be rejected for the wrong job and accepted for the right. So to hell with the deep breaths. If you tell your story, tell your truth, you won't have to worry about taking deep breaths.
Okay, now about the cloud. The cloud is, as I see it, the biggest vulnerability to any computer system. The worst thing that anyone can do is store vital data, especially your own secrets, on a cloud, because it's the easiest thing for hackers to get to. I don't know if you've ever heard of DEF CON. DEF CON is the hackers convention in Las Vegas. It was last week. There's a bunch of black hats that show up. They had over 1,000 people this year. One of my friends who's a hacker, his name is Steve Scheer. Steve was one of the presenters at the Black Hat Convention, and they talk about the cloud as being basically a playground for hackers.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much for the call. It raises a concern, but I don't think we're going back to storing all this data on your own private computers. Anyway, let's take one more call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest, D.S. Kane, the former spy, author of Blood Ridge and four other spy novels. Welcome to the show. What's your question for him?
Hi, I wanted to ask him if he knew about the local author. He has a Vanity Fair column. I can't remember his last name. And he wrote a book that became a movie about the Oakland A's. But he had his house broken into and his computer stolen, probably from the FBI or similar staff. They took his computer, probably because of the book he wrote on the flash trading, the secret.
Oh, Michael Lewis.
Wiring for
Michael
the stock
Lewis.
Market.
Yeah, he's the guy. Michael Lewis, who wrote the book Liar's Poker.
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay.
And does your guest think that's an okay thing to do, to break into a famous author's house and steal his computer?
Never. Especially since I'm an author, and if they break into my house and steal my computer, there go my books.
Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. We're out of time. I want to ask you one more question. You know, you had your books, and I gather, inferring, you know a lot about the Mossad. You mentioned it here, but you mentioned a lot in your books. You know it in detail, Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency. Well, it seems that the relationship of the U.S. to Arab states seems to be getting stronger, while getting weaker with Israel and Mossad. Is that affecting how U.S. intelligence services and Israel's are working together?
The relationship between Israel and the United States is currently in tatters. Some of this is our current administration's fault. Some of this is just the world politic that happens to prevail now. It's hard to say whether Israel has made this a more difficult relationship, but America sure has.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much for being my guest, D.S. Kane, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko. Again, he's written after a decade of being an intelligence service operative, undercover espionage, he has translated what he can into 5 spy novels, the lead one of which is Blood Ridge. Thanks very much again for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
And thank you, Marty, for having me here.
My pleasure. And now we turn to you, my dear listeners. I promise to not deceive you. I will give you straight answers, hopefully, to your problems. So your work-related problems, that is. Or, you know, there's something else. You know, certainly if you've got a career problem, I want you to call. But I'm finding, frankly, while the unemployment rate is down, that ever more people are having to live on ever less. And I'm finding that many of my clients are using me as a source of guidance on how to live well on less. I'm pretty good at the consumer stuff, whether it's buying whatever, it's housing, whether it's avoiding getting ripped off. So I'd like to expand slightly your options in terms of why you can call. Of course, call if you're unemployed, underemployed, well-employed but unhappy. Any kind of work problem for you or someone you love, of course, that's fair game for what I call a workover. But also, if there is something practical that is almost a precursor to landing a good job, or you've got a job and you're having difficulty financially surviving, dealing with the practicalities of, frankly, an ever more challenging life, I invite you to call and see if I can be of help as well. The phone number for any of those reasons is 415-841-4134. That's the number here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko. 415-841-4134. And in the keeping with that survivalist mode, you know, what is ever more, you know, with employers now are so afraid of making a wrong hire that they will make you go through 3, 4, 5 rounds of interviews, not with just one person, but a team. Part of that is the fear of hiring the wrong person. Part of it is we are ever more collaborative. There's no more, you know, one person making a decision. It's all a team. It's a consensus decision. So you're interviewing by this phalanx of people ready to shoot you down. And so you need to have to certainly the where like there was nuclear proliferation, everybody was getting, you know, Israel was getting its 50th nuclear weapon, and then now obviously we're worried about Iran. Same is true of job seekers. As employers are getting ever more sophisticated, so are job seekers in order to break through the clutter and that phalanx of interviews. So it's important that you have these what I call new job search strategies. These days, doing something like sending collateral material and including it with your applications that are not just, you know, your resume and your cover letter, which are widely viewed askance, but a piece of collateral material, whether it be a proposal for what you would do in your first 30 days, a business plan, a white paper. And also, I love in the interview process, there are some interviews that are required by policy or union rules or the government to ask every person the same question. But you can if at all possible, you want to break through the clutter by not just waiting until the end of the interview and asking a question and saying, well, do you have any questions for us? Which they really more they ask for politeness than anything else, but peppering the interview with your asking smart questions, questions that actually show that you're not desperate, questions that show that you're thinking about the job, questions that show that you were listening to what they were saying, questions that show that you were putting yourself into their shoes. So questions like, you know, I noticed you that your company does not try to sell into China, yet your competitors are. What went into that decision? Or, you know, every company has a different corporate culture. Some are more no-nonsense or are so more relational. What makes your corporate culture different? Asking those questions in context, in response to the answers to what they're asking you, can be a way to distinguish yourself and show that you're not desperate. So those are some examples of ways to that are unfortunately required in this ever more competitive market to distinguish yourself. So I want to give out the phone number again. If you could use some help in either distinguishing yourself or being more successful in your work life or someone you love, or again, if there is a kind of a practical issue that one step removed from the act of, you know, your actually work on the job, whether it be regarding finances, a purchase, or even relationships. It's remarkable how much all of my clients, we start with career issues, and it's remarkable how often they want to end up talking about something that affects dramatically whether they're going to be able to be successful in the job. It could be a relationship issue, it could be a finance issue, could even be a health issue. I'm not a doctor, but I certainly have been able to give clients advice about where to turn and how to turn with regard to a health issue. So the phone number here, for all those reasons, if you'd like a 3-minute career makeover, is what I used to call them. Now I call them workovers. The price is certainly right. Zero, zip, or nada. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Also, I want to talk about a new strategy for maximizing your chances of staying hired. Here are a few examples. One is, many people get let go because they just really are kind of procrastinating on the job, and they're not willing to work very hard. And I've learned over the years that one of the most important things you can do is to change your foundational principle from, I'm going to do the least work I can get away with, to do the most as I can reasonably do. I have had clients who, I'll never forget this client who worked for BART, who bragged to me about how she made her 6-figure income working an hour a day. And then she saw me originally because she wanted some just guidance on how to psychologically feel healthier at work. But I got a call back from her 2 years later. So even though she was in a BART job, which is one where it's almost impossible to get fired, she did get fired. So do think about whether you could increase your chance of staying hired and not have to look for a job by changing your foundational principle from do the least work I can get away with to being as productive as I can reasonably be possible. Okay, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi.
Hi.
Is it me?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I've recently gotten into the solar rooftop power plant industry.
Okay.
You know, where they put solar panels on roofs.
Sure.
And there's a number of ways of doing that, and it's the best possible time to be doing it for a lot of reasons. And it's a hard sell still, and the companies that I've worked for so far are spending huge amounts of money trying to generate what they call warm leads.
Yeah.
And the warm leads are turning out to be people that really are misunderstanding the idea that they cost a lot of money, and the companies are relying on that ignorance to try to sell what is basically becoming a commodity.
Absolutely. It's making me pure.
On the basis of some sort of story that you're supposed to
absolutely
spin in a relationship and stuff. So they sell them by the watt, and a solar panel, a good one, that's about 320 watts.
Yeah, what I've been amazed at is, you know, the public, just like the public used to trust universities, so when the universities say, come to our school, it's worth it, we tended to trust them because they were one of the icons that we trusted. But now there's been so many exposés of that colleges are just another business doing whatever they can to get your money. Very often, you know, I don't want to over broadly state it, but it's the same with solar companies. We tend to believe, oh, they're the good guys, they're green, they want to save the planet. But now we hear all kinds of stories about these companies that are acting just like any other company.
They're being taken over in large part by the Goldman Sachs and Google. The two biggest solar installers are SolarCity and Vivint, and they do not sell systems. They rent power to you at a slightly cheaper rate, and then the tax benefits and all those advantages go to their investors, Goldman Sachs.
Well, I don't know if those are the major investors, but I do know that SolarCity, as an example, is one of those that really has a very, let's just say, high-powered sales force. So, anyway, what was the reason for your call?
Here I am floundering around. I've gone from the highest price local providers to a medium-priced local provider, from a Vivint provider, and now I'm looking for probably a lower price. And the lower price comes with a hard sell to do more on the house than just solar, which is like re-roof the whole house for more money than cost.
So I want to make sure I understand. You're looking to work as an installer for one of these companies?
No, sales.
You want to be selling from those companies. So, you know.
I've been out on like 50 calls now, and I've found that the customers will not pull the trigger thinking they're going to get a better deal tomorrow.
Here is my
deal. And actually, that's going to go away in a year when they lose all these tax benefits.
Right. So here is my feeling about where the market is. There's too many. I have gotten more solicitations from solar sales.
Right.
It's all, you know, I just blow them off. I really was seriously considering it a couple of years ago, but I've really kind of blown it off for a variety of reasons. I think what's needed is somebody to clear the clutter. Why wouldn't you, instead of selling, why wouldn't you be the good guy who says, you know, I'm going to be the independent consultant who's going to help you make the smartest decision about
that's interesting to say, but it's a hard become a broker sort of. Say, well, this
not a broker.
Company does a better job for you, you know.
Not a broker, because then you're also in the hip pocket and part of the various companies you represent. I want you to be completely independent. And what you would do is you would give talks at solar conferences. There's endless solar conferences and conventions and whatever. And you give a talk that says the seven ways they try to scam you and the seven ways things you should keep in mind. And you will get clients. All those people who spend $20 to come to the solar conference will hire you to clear away the clutter, and you can make a good few hundred dollars for each one of those and be the good guy. Does that make sense?
In a way, it makes sense. It seems a little far-fetched at this point because the saturation of the market, like you say, people are actually taking these opportunities to get back at the company that called them 10 times to get the lead, to finally acquiescing to the lead when they have no intention of buying.
I'm not looking at those people. There are still people every day who are thinking about, your excess cynicism here. The oversupply is in companies selling the product and in sales guys who are high pressure. There is not an oversupply of people to help the still millions of people who want to put solar in their house or are contemplating it. And if you can explain to them, here's how you separate the wheat from the chaff, here's how you don't just pay by the kilowatt, but you can own the damn system, it's a commodity, here's how you can find an independent guy to do it, and if you give those talks at public libraries and especially at alternative energy conventions for the homeowners conferences, they have all these homeowners expos, I do not believe that the market is overcrowded. And on that note, that is my best shot, and I thank you for calling.
Yeah. Bye.
And thanks for calling with Marty Nemco. One thing you're going to get is a straight answer. So if you want a straight answer from me one way or the other, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, for a workover. I will not pummel you, but I will give you a straight answer. No deception, no spying, none of that. That is an illusion. For those of you just joining us, it's an illusion to my previous guest, D.S. Kane, the author of Blood Ridge, who was a former spy. We talked about what it's like to be a spy. The phone number here for a workover, 415-841 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the things that is, while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, one of the things that is unfortunately true and is working so often is that many people have been trying to get a high-level job, and they're not getting it, but their ego makes it very, very difficult for them to take a step down. The term that is used that has kind of helped my clients do that when necessary is to call it a launch pad job. Something, if you can get a lower level job that you can relatively easily get, that might be a way to get back in the door. I'll give you an example. I have a client who has been a principal his whole life, but he's been fired a number of times lately because he's kind of a know-it-all who pontificates. He makes it implies that it's so easy to close the achievement gap when, in fact, it's any teacher who's been in the trenches knows it's certainly not easy. So he gets fired because his teachers look for opportunities to sabotage him. So I told him, I said, you know, he was a very good teacher before. And we keep hearing now, you know, that there are even, especially in Oakland and San Francisco and in Richmond, there is a shortage of teachers. And so maybe this is the time, because he's been now unemployed for a good while and he can't afford it, that he should go and take one of those teaching jobs, excel, and in teachers' meetings, show himself to be leaderly and not pontificating. And he might, that at minimum, bring some income in, which he needs. And secondly, provides a chance for him to show his new and improved self, which is frankly what we've been working on, and showing leadership in those faculty meetings. And then perhaps he can get a job as an assistant principal or as a dean or even as a principal again. So I invite you to ask yourself, if you're one of those many people who have been long-term unemployed and who are not willing to look for anything else, you know, they say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. If you should be looking, taking a step down to some job you could easily get, make treating as a launchpad job, even in the extremists. Let's say, this is an extreme example, but let's say, I'm taking the most extreme example I can. Let's say you are a CEO and you've been trying now for a year, you were let go or whatever, or you quit, and now it's been 2 years, and you've been trying to get a job, and you're getting nothing. And let's just say, instead of just stepping down to try to look for vice president jobs or director jobs, let's say you took a job, I'm taking a little bit, maybe this is kind of a thought experiment, I'm not even sure I'm right about this, but it's an extreme example. You took a job at McDonald's, serving burgers and fries. Do you not think that almost instantly they would see the way in which you work, the fact that you are seeing processes that could be improved, people relationship issues that could be improved among staff, that you are efficient and whatever? You don't think you'd be assistant manager within a week? And then once you were an assistant manager, don't you think then you might be asked to fill in and be the manager when the manager is on vacation? And then when you do that, might you then be able to go to contact McDonald's corporate and say, you know, I was a CEO, but frustrated with sitting around at home, and I said I wanted a job, any job, and I'm not afraid to roll up my sleeves. And so I worked, and I was serving fries and burgers, and then I got promoted within 2 weeks to be assistant manager, and now 2 weeks later, I'm now a substitute manager. I'm eager to get back into the corporate world. Don't you think that's perhaps a better launch pad for getting back into a good remunerative job than continuing after 2 years to look for more CEO jobs? I'm not sure I'm right, but I'm not sure I'm wrong either. And so I'm always trying to come up with new ideas that will be fresh and might work. So what you might want to do, if you indeed have been struggling for a long time to get the job you believe you deserve, but the world is telling you no, might it be worth taking a step or even 4 steps down? I invite you to call. It's unusual. I guess it's the summer. It's a warm day. People are at the beach, whatever, or you're bored with me or whatever the heck it is. The phone number, if you would like some career help, this advice is all very good, but it's also generic. It doesn't apply to you. So if you or someone you love has got a work problem, or as I said, indirectly a work problem, a money-related problem, a relationship-related problem, anything that is impeding you from succeeding and being happy in your work life, I try to help with what I call a workover here on Work with Marty Nemco. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And going further, even further down the hierarchy, if you will, if maybe, you know, you've been looking for full-time jobs all the time, and I've been unwilling to look for something part-time, temp, helping out a friend on a project. Might that not be a good idea? But most people say, oh, I can't afford that. I've got a mortgage. I've got my kids, and I've got these high expenses. So is the question really that maybe you should simplify your life and do something like, the biggest cost is housing. Do you really need to pay that much for housing? Should you try to get something sub-market rent? There is, in many rich areas, beautiful areas, there are people with backyard cottages or attic apartments or whatever, that the owner is not that interested in extracting maximum dollars, but willing to, wanting company. My first housing in Berkeley was in the most beautiful home in the world. It's probably worth $5 million now. It was an old woman who was wanting company in her house. I paid $83 a month. The equivalent in today's dollars of $400 a month. So, yes, the average market rate is ridiculous, but your job, my job, is to help you go under the radar. So isn't it funny how you guys, you don't recall it all, and now all the lines are lighted up. There must have been something I said that had some value. So anyway, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Can you hear me?
I hear you beautifully.
Wonderful. Thank you. I've called you before. I hope I haven't called you on this particular issue. I have a decluttering business. I am really good at helping people get organized, and I'm very good with extreme clutter and hoarding.
Right.
Not so much working with hoarders, but working in a situation where the hoarder is in the hospital or they've died and the family needs to clear out the home.
Okay.
But I can help ordinary people clear out their closets. And I've had the business going in kind of a half-assed way for about 5 years. And I picked real estate people and senior facilities that are trying to get people to move into their facility as some of my target audiences. And I'm not overcome with business.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you because I know you have called three times about this. I do recall you very well. So the tip, I always try to add one little bit of value. There is people called private fiduciaries. Private fiduciaries are people who are stated in a will or a trust to administer, to take care of all the crap after somebody dies. They are under the radar. They're not like, the real estate agent. So I'd be contacting private fiduciaries and asking them if they need somebody. Also banks, trust departments. Every bank, many banks, especially there's certain banks like Mechanics Bank and First Republic Bank that have big trust departments, and they will often be in a position, they often are charged with administering after somebody dies. So I encourage you to contact trust departments and banks as well as private fiduciaries. I thank you for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes, I want to know if there is reputable work-at-home businesses.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. Most of the ones that are advertised on the Internet are not. The ones that really legitimately make the most money include the following. Tutors, editors for people to work, and ghostwriting, various kind of writing, whether it be copywriting for like websites or for catalogs or whatever. Do those jump to mind as clearly at relatively high pay? Because tutors, especially if you're willing to and capable of tutoring special needs kids like autistic kids, they can make $75, $100, $125 an hour for tutoring, and that can be done at home by Skype. Also, I know many music teachers now who do a lot of their teaching by Skype from home. You can get a world-class, especially if you're somebody who lives in rural Arkansas and you're a great violinist, you can get a world-class violin teacher who lives in New York to go and teach you. Do any of those things ring any bells for you?
I do. The tutoring kind of helps me, but, I have had an education. I have an MIS, analyst, business analyst, and I have some accounting. So I don't know how I would do that, stay-at-home business, be a tutor.
Okay, a couple of things. Now, am I hearing a hint of an accent? Are you from another? Is your native language something other than English?
Indian, maybe.
Right. Okay. So, but you're very, very acculturated, clearly. Your English is excellent, and I know many Indians speak English in India. But Would you, I mean, here's an example of the kind of business you could do locally. Would you, if, especially if you're well-connected to some aspects of the Indian community, had you ever thought about being an acculturation coach or a language coach, people, or an accent reduction coach to people from India? Your background makes you uniquely qualified. Or there are indeed many analysts, virtual assistants, virtual analysts who work remotely from home. Using that skill as an analyst you have, there are companies who will be thrilled to let you work at home because you are not taking up office space there. So, for example, whether it be on TaskRabbit or it be on what they call Upwork now, is that they used to be Odesk, looking for jobs as an analyst that you could work from home. Do any of those ideas, whether it be an acculturation or accident reduction coach or a analyst person doing your work from home, do any of those resonate for you?
Absolutely, because that communication has been the key as far as getting me good jobs. And, I would like to, I have to write that down, TaskRabbit, and what was the other one?
Well, no, TaskRabbit's a little bit too low level. I wouldn't use that, but I would use Upwork. And I have a new idea that amalgamates both. What if you are somebody who has been an analyst, and many analysts are not native speakers of English, and they are relegated to low-level analyst jobs because of their lack of English, as well as cultural competence and, you know, kind of standard American. What if you were to coach analysts in how to communicate better, non-English speaking, non-native speakers of English, all those millions of Indian analysts who do exist, and helping them to develop communication skills, leadership skills, American culture understanding skills, that you can do from home and that you're uniquely qualified for. How about that?
That sounds good. It's called Upwork what?
Well, Upwork is something else. Upwork is going to get you temp jobs for analyst work. I'm saying you could create a consultancy where by home, by Skype or phone, you can consult with analysts, working analysts, who feel like they are reaching a glass ceiling because their communication skills or lack of understanding of American culture are keeping them in low-level analyst jobs rather than team lead or project lead jobs. You could coach them from home. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. So I have to kind of build my own business, build my own marketing.
Through your network, it's not going to come through strangers. If you've been an analyst for a long time, the wisest thing you could do would be to make a list of all the people who are analysts whom you know and who like you, especially those from India, and pitch yourself that way. And don't pitch yourself hard sell. You don't need to be hard sell. Say, you know, this is something I'm not kind of naturally good at. I've got good communication skills. I'm from India originally. Do you know some person who maybe is from India, maybe some other Asian country, who is, you know, could use some improved skills in their people skills, in their cultural skills, in their accent reduction skills, and get referrals from your friends? That's how you organically build a business without having to become a marketer. Does that make sense?
Sounds good.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Okay, now, of course, that's what happens. You wait till the last second, dear listeners, and you can't get your butts on the air because there's not enough time. I've only got about 40 seconds, so dudes and dudettes, would you please call next week and call earlier because I love helping you, but I can't help you when there's no time. All right. The final thing, you know, we're talking about, I was talking about the range of options for people who are long-term job seekers who just can't, can't land something. And we talked about a variety of job search techniques. We talked about revising your job circuit to a launchpad job. This is kind of, and we talked about cutting expenses, living a simpler life, finding that under the radar, basement apartment or backyard cottage or whatever. This is a dirty word, the R word. I was talking about the R word, retirement word, before the show. The world seems to be divided. Half the people who retire are happy they retired. They enjoy the time with their spouse or their hobbies or writing spy novels or whatever. I mean, there are others who go crazy. So you really need to be the kind of person who knows that you will fill your life. Because remember, once it's like the Roach Motel. You go, you can check in, but you can't check out. So normally when you retire, it's very hard to get in. To get back into the workforce. So you need to ask yourself over a 10, 20, 30-year period of retirement, are you going to be able to stay busy? But if you are one of that half or whatever percentage of people who really would fill their life with something they would enjoy more, their spouse, their writing, their volunteer work, their whatever, because believe me, travel gets old. You know, you travel after a while and you get sick of the stupid TSA and waiting in lines and delayed flights and getting screwed by the, you know, as a tourist, you know. But so don't think you're going to travel. You're not going to travel that much. You're going to travel for a while. It's not going to fill up your 30 years. But certainly wait as passionately whether you should consider retirement. That is one of the options for those people who just can't seem to find a job long term. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Do call in earlier! Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on calls. And if your child has just graduated from college and wanted to pursue a career as an artist or an actor or a musician, something like that, and to date had just earned $1,000 for her or his creative output, would you encourage your kid to continue? My wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I are going to have a switch sides in the middle debate on that very question. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.